From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with ABC White House correspondent Sam Donaldson. He's known for his frank, some would say arrogant, questioning. Also, I'll talk with South African novelist Nadine Gordimer. Her latest book, A Sport of Nature, follows a white South African woman as her country ends apartheid and turns to majority rule. Our jazz critic Francis Davis reviews the latest recording by saxophonist Henry Threadgill. He says the album shows jazz moving toward a greater emphasis on composition. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews NBC's new show, The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air is ABC White House correspondent Sam Donaldson. His trademark is the aggressive, pointed question, Samisms, as they're called by some of his colleagues. Cartoonist Gary Trudeau nicknamed him the human bullhorn for his manner of shouting those questions on occasions when the president is trying to deflect the press, like when he's boarding his helicopter. To many viewers and some of his fellow reporters, Donaldson's jolting line of questioning is abrasive, if not rude. Others applaud him for never letting our leaders off the hook. Sam Donaldson joined ABC in 1968, became White House correspondent in 77, and has been a regular on This Week with David Brinkley since 81. He's just written a memoir. It's titled Hold On, Mr. President. Sam Donaldson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry. It's good to be here.
Loudness and aggressiveness are two of your trademarks as far as your line of questioning. When does it really pay to be loud and aggressive?
Well, let's separate them. I'm aggressive by nature. I think I always have been. I talk in the book about how when I was 7 years of age and the United States entered World War II, I defended my country. One night on the farm that I lived on in southern New Mexico, I saw a German tank come through the farmyard. I rushed it. I threw up in the hatch. I dropped in a Molotov cocktail. Actually, it was the farm truck, and I'd unscrewed the gas tank, and I'd put in a match, and it went boom. So aggressiveness is not something that I put on as an act to go down to the White House. But I think a reporter who sits in the back row by habit and speaks only when spoken to doesn't really have what it takes to cover a kind of a high-pressure beat. That reporter may be very valuable someplace else doing something else. But at the White House, you've got to be aggressive. Now, loudness is another thing. I'm not shouting at you now. And no one ever said he shouted at Jimmy Carter. Because Jimmy Carter always came close to us and talked to us and would answer questions. We saw him almost every day. But Ronald Reagan is sequestered from the press. They keep him away. He keeps himself away. So the choices, when he's out in public, the only chance we have during those periods when he hasn't held a press conference in 3 or 4 months to question him, the only choices are keep quiet, do exactly what they like, or shout. I shout. And often Ronald Reagan shouts back, and he makes news.
So you started doing that for President Reagan.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I've shouted at people during the 30-some-odd years I've been a reporter, but not regularly. And no, Gary Trudeau never thought to mention that I was the human bullhorn when I was covering Capitol Hill. It's only been because Ronald Reagan gives you that choice.
Some people say that if you didn't exist, that the Reagan administration would have to invent you.
I don't really think they'd want to do that, do you?
Well, an example that's sometimes given is that your manner can make the press seem rude and disrespectful, and thereby the president earns the sympathy of the public.
I don't believe that. I mean, I don't think the American public works that way. I don't think that if the facts bring a president out all wrong, but reporters are rude and disrespectful, the American public will say, it doesn't matter to me that he sold arms to Iran. Those reporters are so rude and disrespectful, that's more important. See, that is non-logic. That is not thought. And therefore, I don't believe that the people in the White House would invent me for that reason if I didn't exist. But may I say, Terry, I have never purposely, knowingly, ask a question that I meant to be rude or disrespectful at all. Maybe it's like beauty. Maybe it's in the eye of the perceiver. But I ask direct questions. Sometimes they are blunt because I think that's the way they ought to be put. But I don't need them to be rude.
Some people say that the blunt questions also play into the president's hands because you can ask your tough, blunt question and then he can make some kind of quip in response, and then it's all over.
Well, Ronald Reagan does
question.
One-liners, right? He avoids answering questions he doesn't want to answer by occasionally doing the one-liner. My favorite is when Andrea Mitchell of NBC asked him in 1984, during an election campaign which the president chose not to recognize was occurring, as he was leaving the Rose Garden one day, Andrea shouted at him, "Well, Mr. President, what about Mondale's charges?" "Well," he said, "he ought to pay them." Well, it's very funny. I mean, it's humorous, and he avoided answering. But the direct question is the one that a good politician always likes. To that extent, Terry, I play into their hands, I suppose. If you ask someone, "Why are you such a great person?" Well, what can they say? They can say, "Thank you." But if you say, "Your opponents say that you don't pay any attention to the poor and you only like rich people," what do you have to say to that? Well, they stand up and they hit it out of the park.
One other criticism that's sometimes been directed at you is that part of your style is showboating, theatrical flair to call attention to yourself.
Well, I don't do it for that purpose, but let me tell you something. Howard K. Smith once told me when I first came to Washington, he said, "The greatest sin in television news is to be dull." Well, I thought he was wrong. I thought, well, the greatest sin must be to be inaccurate, or to be incomplete, or to be biased. I went down the whole list of Journalism 301 sins. Now I understand what he meant, and I agree with him. After you have been accurate and unbiased to the extent you can, and as complete as possible, if you then are so dull that no one listens to you, no one reads you, no one watches you, you haven't communicated. I mean, the best communicators, whether they were Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite or Peter Jennings, if you will, are people who are not dull. And so if I'm not dull, I'm not doing it to showboat, I'm doing it to communicate.
Is there an etiquette you have to follow when you're asking the president a question, no matter how tough the question is? What kind of language do you have to couch it in?
Well, I try to make my language respectful. That's why I say I disagree that I ask disrespectful questions. For instance, we try to avoid the L word. Now, the L word is lie. You know, often the president misstates the facts, we will say, or doesn't quite get it right, we will say. For instance, last November 19th at his press conference, Ronald Reagan told us four times that he knew of no third country involved in the sale of U.S. arms to Iran. He knew that that was not the case. He knew that that was not the fact. But on March 19th, when Chris Wallace, at a press conference then, asked him about it, Chris didn't say, "Mr. President, why did you lie to us?" He used other words, euphemisms. So, yes, I think there's a certain protocol. But you see, Terry, I would do that to the mayor of Philadelphia. I wouldn't use the word lie to him either. I would say, "You misstated the facts. Why did you do that?"
Why can't you use the word lie?
You can, but it's one of those abrasive words that gets in the way then of communication. Look, I'm trying to get information. I'm not showboating when I ask Ronald Reagan a question. I'm not doing it to hear myself talk. I'm not doing it just for exercise. I want information to pass along to the public. And when you use that kind of a flash word, now the hackles go up and it gets in the way.
You have, I believe, a front row center seat at most of the press conferences, the presidential press conferences. Who makes the sitting arrangements?
The White House. I mean, yes, if you left it up to me, I'd sit on the front row every time. But it's not me. The White House decides it wants the major news organizations with the widest audience or distribution on the front row. So they put ABC News there. When I sit there, Terry, and the president calls on me, I know he's not calling on his old buddy Sam, without whose question no press conference would be complete. He's calling on the correspondent from ABC News because he thinks it serves his purposes to do so. I happen to fill that seat at the moment. That's why I get up and I ask a question. Now, I'm delighted, but if I worked for a much smaller news organization, I'd be on the last row, on the last seat, and he probably wouldn't be able to find his old buddy Sam.
It seems that it's really easy at a press conference situation for a president to avoid the question, to not really answer it. Maybe you'll have a follow-up, but then it's on to the next reporter.
That's right.
What's the trick to phrasing a question so that it stands a better chance of actually getting a response?
Well, in Ronald Reagan's case, you want to keep it a simple, direct question. Now, I made a mistake at the last press conference on March 19th. I wanted to ask him about this assertion of his that he couldn't remember when he had authorized that first Israeli shipment of arms to Iran. He couldn't remember whether it was before or after the shipment. Instead of just asking him why he couldn't remember, I went into a long, detailed phrasing of What Robert McFarlane had said was the conversation that he had had with the president, at which Robert McFarlane, Mr. Reagan's former national security advisor, asserts the president gave the okay. But in doing that, I not only confused Mr. Reagan, but I gave him an opportunity to answer anything he wants. So when I can get my act together and remember what to do, I ask a simple, direct question with a point. Do you agree? Why did you do that? What is your policy? Now, you're right. He can slip off and answer anything he wants. But if he does, the public sees that he's dodging the question. I get to ask the questions. He gets to give the answers. I can't make him answer the question, but I can sure put it in a position where if he doesn't, it's clear.
Reporters and people on programs like the Sunday Morning Show that you appear on need access to the president and also to the cabinet and to all the White House officials. Are you given access sometimes in return for what's seen as a favorable story?
Well, they've never given me access for a favorable story.
Well, not just to the president, but to anyone in the cabinet.
No, I'll tell you how you gain access. And it's very difficult in the Reagan White House because most of the time he's been in office there, the watchword has been secrecy and keep him out. I think you gain access if officials believe that you play it straight and that you're not going to deliberately distort what they say or what they're doing. That's the way you gain access. And number two, it depends on who you work for. Now, on any given day, Terry, maybe a dozen reporters will call the chief of staff's office to want to talk to Howard Baker, Donald T. Regan, Jim Baker in the first term. Who does he call back? Well, they often call back the Washington Post or the New York Times, because those papers set an agenda, and they know that Donaldson and Wallace and Plant will pick up the Post in the morning, read it, and say, my goodness, here's the news, go out and reproduce it on television that night. Whereas if they call me back, I'll put it on ABC, but the others may not pick it up. So it's a very cold-hearted decision about who will do us the most good. That, too, is part of access.
I think all presidential administrations want television play. Everybody wants access to TV. And a lot of photo opportunities and setups are done for the purposes of having good pictures for television. What's an example of a setup that was really done to get good TV? And did you feel like you had to actually cover the story in that way,
well,
even though you were on to it?
I give one of the best examples in the book that I've written about Ronald Reagan going to Europe and celebrating the 40th anniversary of D-Day on the beaches of Normandy. Now, it was an important occasion. I mean, Americans who fought in the war or who know something about World War II, it's almost a solemn event. But the president's day was planned so meticulously for television. Michael K. Deaver found the spot where the Rangers had scaled the cliff at Pont de Hoc on that first day, many of them losing their lives. The script that Mr. Reagan read was written for him by a White House speechwriter. She's just terrific, and she writes the words beautifully. The president himself, as we know, has this experience as an actor, so that if you give him the material and you tell him, as Deaver did that day, where to stand, so the sun was just right and the background was there. And Deaver then had also brought along some of the old veterans, the Rangers who had survived and were still alive, and they're sitting there, and they're watching all of this. And now, here it comes, Ronald Reagan saying, these are the boys of Pont de Hoc. These are the men who won the peace. What brings tears to your eyes? Well, on that particular day, I could not bring myself to point out that the red mark where he stood had been carefully plotted and that the Rangers had been brought over as part of the Reagan extravaganza. I thought to myself, he's got us. You cannot trash D-Day. And I let him have it. But in so many examples, the president and his people, and others using television, I shouldn't just beat Ronald Reagan over the head, use the medium to get across not just their message, but the image that they want projected. Never mind the words, because the eye always predominates over the ear if there is a clash. So during the campaign of 84, when Mr. Reagan would go out with balloons, American flags, Bibles, a lot of people cheering, and Lee Greenwood singing God Bless the USA by his side, I would point out that he was not discussing the issues. He wasn't telling us how he was going to cut his budget. Didn't matter. You saw the balloons, and it was all wonderful.
Well, it's really a contradictory story that you get. On the one hand, you see this picture of of joy and effervescence with the balloons, and on the other hand, you hear your commentary about how he's not really talking about the issue. So which do you think penetrates more to the listener?
It's the picture. It's the picture every time. Unless, of course, you're looking at someone who's a mean guy, who's frowning instead of smiling. Now, Jimmy Carter didn't come across that well on television, at least during his presidency as opposed to his campaign.
Would it be possible for TV to stop playing ball with the photo opportunity, the totally staged news event?
It's a good question, but it's not as simple as saying, well, of course, why don't we just put on what's news? First of all, television is pictures. There's no other reason to have television. We might as well have radio, which is a fine medium. But if I'm going to use television, we need to show people things that are happening, the people who are doing things. So we sort of tend to gravitate toward the pictures, and they know it. Secondly, if a politician decides to run a political campaign which is nothing but balloons, it's easy, I guess, in one sense, to say to him, well, I'm sorry, you're not running the political campaign that I think is required and the American people deserve. Therefore, I will not put your political campaign on the air. I'm not so certain, although you and I might agree in the case of balloons, but as we make the subject more complex, that I ought to have the right to decide that I'm the campaign manager, thank you very much, and I'm going to put it on only if it pleases my vision of what a campaign should be. It's very difficult. I think they really have us if they know how to use the medium.
Sam Donaldson, we're going to take a short break. My guest is ABC White House correspondent Sam Donaldson, who's written a new memoir titled Hold On, Mr. President. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
You're in a really competitive beat. There is a huge pack of reporters from around the country, from around the world, covering the White House. Do you have to be very aggressive? What's the most aggressive thing that either you've done or you've witnessed to get a story ahead of someone else?
Well, I think, yes, you have to be aggressive. And I think the thing I've tried to do over the years is try to get there first and get there before the competition. And often that means moving forward first. At some of the conventions, I've sort of have a reputation for moving up and talking to people before the competition can get there. When Jimmy Carter was nominated in 1976 at Madison Square Garden, after he made his nominating speech, Bob Strauss, who was then the party chairman, began to bring on to the platform every politician he could find. As I said, the county tax assessor of Bernalillo County, New Mexico, might have been up there and been introduced on television for all I remember. And it suddenly occurred to me that we all wanted to interview Jimmy Carter. Why not do it? So I just walked onto the stage. Before that, they didn't have the guards to keep us off, and I started interviewing Mr. Carter. The others ran up after a while. Actually, it wasn't over 2 or 3 minutes, but it might as well have been a lifetime, because if you get there first, then you control the interview. So that kind of aggressive behavior, I think, is within the bounds.
You were the first reporter to break the story of the assassination attempt on President Reagan. And at the time you witnessed it, you thought that he wasn't shot, and that's what you reported to ABC. And I think you were live on the air with Frank Reynolds when he was passed a note saying that, in fact, the president had been shot. What went through your mind when, live on the air, you found out that...
I was horrified. I'd watched Mr. Reagan's face as the gunshots, as Hinckley, who was 5 feet from me, was shooting at him. And I saw a quizzical look just an instant before his Secret Service guards threw him, pushed him into the limousine. But it seemed to me it was a natural look of someone who's saying, my goodness, I mean, someone's shooting at me. Your face is not going to have that wonderful Reagan-esque smile on it. Actually, we know now the president didn't think he'd been shot. No one did for quite some time. And I reported very carefully that while I had seen no evidence that he was shot, I couldn't be certain. But later the White House seemed to confirm that he hadn't been shot. So when they passed a note to Frank that, in fact, the president was in the hospital with a bullet in him and he was going into surgery, I was horrified that I had misled people. Yes, I didn't mean to, but that doesn't cut much ice when the bottom line is you've made a mistake like that, particularly a mistake of that magnitude. I mean, if I'd misreported the number of a bill going through the Senate, it wouldn't bother me that much. But something like that is very, very destructive. I'll tell you another instance, if I may. It's not in the book. But I think the worst thing that I've done, again, inadvertently, was just last year. We were working in our newsroom one Sunday afternoon, preparing for our Sunday evening news broadcast, when the word came that a plane had gone out of the sky over a Los Angeles suburb. So we got as many details as we could, and the whole city block was in flame. I mean, this plane had destroyed houses on the ground. I mean, there was carnage everywhere. So we did a bulletin on ABC, and I reported that. While I was on the air, my producer said into my ear, "It's a PSA airliner." We've confirmed that, so I said, and it now appears that it was a PSA airliner. Well, it wasn't. It was an Aeronaves from Mexico airliner. Think of all the people on the West Coast that heard me say that their loved ones are flying PSA that day. These kinds of mistakes, and I've now given you a worst example, but it happened to me. These kind of mistakes are tragic. But what people ought to understand is, you know, we do the best we can. We try to be as careful as possible. But they are not mistakes we make deliberately or because we just, in some shoddy sense, pay no attention to the facts.
Is the mistake like the mistake about saying that Reagan had not been hit by a bullet? Is that a function of the rush to be first? Is that the price you sometimes pay for being the first one with a story?
Well, obviously, we'd rather be right than first. Anyone who says opposite is a fool. But at what point do you think you've got enough information to be right? Well, in a sense, you ought to wait forever. There is never enough information to be right, I suppose. And you can't do that. That's not realistic.
ABC White House correspondent Sam Donaldson is my guest. Are fellow reporters who are from smaller markets really starstruck when they start covering the White House and are, you know, in the pack with star reporters like yourself?
Well, I don't think of myself as a star reporter. I've been around a while, and I think I know something about the beat. But I don't, I mean, boy, if you start believing your press clippings as a reporter, you are lost. I carry my own bags, and unlike Jimmy Carter, I'm not running for anything. Excuse me, Dan. Excuse me, Mr. President. So I don't look at it that way. I think Washington is a unique beat. I think you ought to have some experience in Washington before you come to the White House, because you need to know something about the other power elements in town. I think young reporters, once they get onto something, they can outrun me, and therefore they do better than I do.
I think women on TV have to really be, the way it is now, very concerned about their hair and their makeup and the clothes they're wearing. What do men who are on TV every night reporting for the national news have to concern themselves with?
I think men and women both have to concern themselves with keeping up with what's going on, because the tendency after you do something for some length of time is, well, I know this, and I know how to report this, and I make most of my mistakes when I think I know something and I don't check it. But as far as women are concerned, Terry, they have to give 110% still in this business just to stay even.
No, I take it for granted that you have to know what you're talking about, but let's face it, television is very obsessed with image, and I think a lot of the pressure of image is really put on the women. But I wonder how much pressure is on men to look a certain way. Do you have worry a lot about your hair?
There is a double standard, so the pressure isn't that strong on men. I give you my good friend Charles Kuralt. I mean, Charlie does very well, but he's probably not everyone's ideal pinup boy. And I think you can go up and down the line and find at all of the networks those kinds of people who don't have to pay that much attention to what is seen to be the Pepsi generation appearance. Now, the three anchormen of the major television networks at the moment do look pretty good. That may be a factor, and they may have to worry about that, but let me tell you, I don't.
One of the trademarks of your image on TV, I think, is your very bushy eyebrows. Right. When you were getting started in television, did anyone tell you that you'd have to change them in any way?
No one, everyone's kidded me about them, and some people have pointed out that maybe I look satanic. I mean, old Nick himself. When I first started in the news business in Washington, though, one of my first boss suggested to me I might want to use my full name, because in those days it was Edward P. Morgan, Howard K. Smith, Edward R. Murrow. Well, that people don't run around down the street saying, "What's your name?" Edward R. Murrow. They say Ed Murrow. So I said, no, I said, my name is Sam Donaldson. I could say Samuel A. Donaldson, but I really don't think that's going to make me any wiser. And fortunately, he agreed. And now it's out of style.
You co-founded when you were young. You co-founded the Young Republicans Club of El Paso. Have your politics changed since then?
I suppose so, yes. I mean, my mother gave me a little blurb for the back of my book, and it says, Sam was always an obedient child until he went back east. Well, in a sense, I think she's not talking about my being disobedient to her, but the fact that I changed somewhat. When I grew up in the Southwest, that's why I think I understand Ronald Reagan's conservative philosophy. I too, learned that if a man was able-bodied and out of a job, he was a bum. There couldn't be any other reason. I mean, you could pick cotton for 2 cents a pound. You could chop weeds for $2-3 a day. I mean, well, how much did you need? Mr. Reagan, I think, still thinks something along those lines. But then when I went back east and I saw people who didn't have jobs because they didn't have any language, they didn't have any education, they might have been discriminated against for reasons they could do nothing about, I took a little different view. So I suppose my politics have changed. People think of me now on the Brinkley Show when I argue with George Will as a flaming liberal. I'm not a flaming liberal, but on some issues, I clearly do have a liberal viewpoint.
Is it bad to say that publicly?
No. Why shouldn't I? I mean, Chris Wallace has a viewpoint. Leslie Stahl has a viewpoint. Bill Plant has a viewpoint. They don't have what I consider to be the opportunity to give it in a broadcast like the Brinkley Show. But they have it. The test, Terry, is whether we keep our viewpoints, our personal viewpoints, out of our work Monday through Friday. And the fact that you know what mine is doesn't mean I do it any less or any more than my colleagues.
Now, I understand you would like to leave the White House beat after Reagan finishes out his final term in the presidency. Why do you want to leave?
Because I've done it too long. I will have done it 12 years then, and I think ABC is best served to have new blood come in, reinvent the wheel. Don't make the mistakes I make now because I think I know what to do.
Well, you're thinking about yourself, too, I'm sure,
yes.
Not just the
I need a new challenge.
Okay.
Hey, I'm altruism is fine, but I need a new challenge. I need to go on to something that I haven't thought I've mastered yet and have a crack at it. I am on the downhill slide, kid. I'm 53 now. I'll be 55 when I leave the White House. I still think I'll have some good years ahead of me, but I want to use whatever experience I have to the maximum advantage. I want to run something. I mean, I understand what George Bush feels when he says it's great being number two, but let me ask you, do you know what tune they play when the Vice President of the United States comes into the room?
Oh, what tune?
Well, I don't know either, but they have one, but it's not Hail to the Chief. So I'm not saying I have to be the chief, but I'm saying I want to run a news broadcast. I want to help fashion it and shape it rather than just be one of the important contributors to it. This sounds like a job advertisement. If it is, so be it.
So you
Are you listening, Rune?
You want to be the president of a network news operation?
No, I like being on the air. If you scratch any one of us...
You want to be an anchor, then?
Including you, Terry. One of the reasons we enjoy doing what we do, there's some ham in us. We do enjoy actually being up front. And I enjoy it, and I want to continue doing it.
So this means you want to be an anchor who is involved with the running of the
Doesn't
broadcast.
Doesn't have to be a daily news broadcast. It can be something else. Invent some new programming. But I do want to do something other than pick up those bags and jump on that bus and get on that plane. And they have everybody say someday, boy, for an old geezer like him, he can still move.
One more thing. You're at the pinnacle of your profession.
Not yet, I hope.
But do you ever feel like there really aren't that many options open? Because after all, how many really terrific slots are there in broadcasting?
At ABC, I think there are only one or two jobs that are better than mine, and they are filled now by very good people, and they're going to not be open. I understand that. So the higher you go, I mean, at some point, if you get elected to the city council, you can dream of not only being president, but there are a lot of other positions in between. When you get to be George Bush, there's only one place to go. It's up or out.
Okay. Sam Donaldson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
My guest has been Sam Donaldson, ABC's White House correspondent. He's written a memoir titled Hold On, Mr. President. This is Fresh Air. On the next show, I'll speak with Tipper Gore. She's pressured the music industry to put cautionary labels on rock albums with sexually explicit or violent lyrics. So I hope you can join us. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional funds from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with South African novelist Nadine Gordimer. Her latest book, A Sport of Nature, follows a white South African woman coming of age in the days nearing the end of white rule. Also, music critic Francis Davis says the new jazz album by saxophonist Henry Threadgill shows the re-emergence of the composer in jazz. Television critic David Bianculli reviews the latest addition to NBC's Thursday night lineup, The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. And we'll have the latest news from National Public Radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. We have our weekly jazz review now with music critic Francis Davis. Jazz is always called the improviser's art, but there's a new emphasis on composition in some of the most original music in jazz today. Francis says a good example of this is the new album You Know the Number by saxophonist Henry Threadgill.
Jazz scripture insists that composition is a frill, at best the springboard to improvisation, at worst an impediment to it. But jazz scripture also insists on progress, and in the past few years, improvisers have been retracing their steps. Composers have been the ones breaking new ground. Henry Threadgill is a perfect example of such a composer. Threadgill is probably best known as the saxophonist in Air, the cooperative trio from Chicago that won applause for Air Lore, their 1979 album of Scott Joplin and Jelly Roll Morton compositions. The widespread critical acclaim for Air Lore was partially based on a misunderstanding, though. Air Lore triggered the realization that great jazz composers shouldn't have to be physically present in order for their works to be performed. But it should also have triggered the realization that composition didn't have to remain a dirty secret any longer. The plaudits for Air as a unit deflected attention from Henry Threadgill, the band's most prolific and ambitious composer, and its most commanding soloist. But it's been impossible to overlook Threadgill since he began moonlighting as leader of his own sextet. RCA Novus has just released You Know the Number. This is the fourth album by the Henry Threadgill Sextet since 1972, but the first one on a label large enough to give this fabulous music the promotion and distribution it deserves. Not to overlook the improvisatory prowess of Threadgill and his band members, what's special about You Know the Number is Threadgill's writing. It's painterly in its tonal abstraction, cinematic in its emotional ratio. I could choose any of the album's six tracks as an example, but the piece that strikes the most satisfying bargain between composition and improvisation is Silver and Gold, baby, Silver and Gold. It's a dirge for commiserating bass, cello, and alto saxophone. We'll pick it up from the middle, beginning with Threadgill's alto solo. It's a largely improvised passage, ironically, but a good illustration of how, for Threadgill, composition doesn't cease when the solos begin. Saxophonist Henry Threadgill from his new LP, You Know the Number. I suppose a valid criticism of this album might be that Threadgill is so even-handed a bandleader that he shortchanges himself as a soloist. For those who prefer to hear him in a less structured setting, I can recommend Air Show, the excellent new LP by Air on the Black Saint label. It features six yeasty Threadgill compositions, some with vocals by his wife, the singer Cassandra Wilson. Together, Air Show and You Know the Number confirm Henry Threadgill's preeminence among jazz composers in a period in which the composer is finally usurping the improviser as the pivotal figure in jazz.
Jazz critic Francis Davis is the author of In the Moment, Jazz in the 1980s. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is white South African novelist Nadine Gordimer. She continues to live and work in South Africa, despite the fact that three of her novels were at one time banned by her country's government. Her stories began to appear here in the 1950s, and she became known for her portraits of ordinary people caught up in the drama and contradictions of the times they lived in. Her latest novel is called A Sport of Nature. It's about the present and future of South Africa, as seen through the life of a white South African Jewish girl named Halela. Halela's life revolves around the men she knows and later marries, including a black revolutionary leader. I asked Nadine Gordimer if she expresses her own opposition to apartheid through her writing.
Not at all. When I'm writing novels or stories, I'm doing my work, the thing that I'm best fitted to do. I wouldn't ever put such ability as I have as an artist at the service of any cause, however much I personally felt attached to it. That would be writing propaganda. I'm not a propagandist. But in my private life as an individual, it is there that I support very strongly the cause of liberation in South Africa, in my actions and in my words as a private person.
Do you think that your books have contributed to the cause?
I would like to think so, from the point of view that they inform people outside at a depth at which the media, news media, cannot, of how laws actually shape people's lives and their emotions, what these laws do to people when they live under such a regime. And I think this is true of all writers, all imaginative writers who live under some kind of oppression. It fleshes out the facts for the rest of the outside world, and I think also helps the people within the country to understand what has been done with them, what they have become, to understand their own reactions and begin to have doubts. And I think doubt is a very healthy thing for people to feel, begin to question yourself.
The main character in your book is Jewish. And your father was a Jew who fled Tsarist Lithuania. And it's ironic that he fled oppression and then moved to a country where he would end up being identified as an oppressor by virtue of his skin color. Was that an irony that you felt growing up?
No, I didn't feel that at all when I was growing up, but I certainly feel it now. Of course it is an irony, very much so.
Does it make it any easier to be accepted and trusted in black revolutionary circles if you're not an Afrikaner?
Yes, I think it does. Though even if you're not an Afrikaner, you still have to prove by word and deed that you really do identify with the liberation cause. It's not enough just to say, you know, I'm with you. You've got to show that you really are. And there are Afrikaners who've done this too.
Was there a turning point in your life where you decided to side with the revolutionary struggle?
I think it's been a slow process. I was born in that small town, a little mining town near Johannesburg. I lived the ordinary life of any white child, totally cut off from black people except insofar as they were around doing menial jobs. And then when I moved to Johannesburg as a young writer, I moved in the sort of set that you find everywhere. I think that the people in the arts are freer of prejudice than other people, because they're all breaking all sorts of other conventions as well. So then I began to move freely with blacks, and found that with some of them I had far more in common than I had with whites. In other words, we had community of interest in writing or in another form of the arts, and so friendships were formed. Then when I moved to Johannesburg in the 1950s, it was the time of the big passive resistance campaigns. I could have taken part in them, but I didn't. I think I was a slow developer. I was looking on from the outside. I felt very sympathetic and supportive, but I didn't go there to the sit-ins. I didn't get myself involved in that way. And the active involvement came latterly as I got to know and saw more and more deeply what was happening in the country and the extent of the oppression. So I became more involved.
Has the government ever offered you any kind of deals, for instance, that if you didn't associate publicly with black revolutionaries, that they wouldn't ban your books?
No, I'm afraid not. I don't think they regard writers as important enough to make that sort of deal.
The way you've described the writers' importance in South Africa, it sounds like writers, as far as the government is concerned, is more of a thorn in their side than any real threat.
Exactly.
Well, why is that so?
Well, where would the writers represent a threat? Have they ever represented a threat in your own country, in England?
Well,
no.
In America, writers complain that they're not taken seriously enough.
Well, I think that is the whole point, that governments don't take writers seriously. And the effect that writers have on the public is, as I've said, a slow business, but it often goes very deep. But I think governments don't see this. They don't take much notice of writers. I think the French are the only people who've ever felt that writers were worth listening to, and even made some of their poets diplomats at a certain time. But it certainly isn't general anywhere else in the English-speaking world that I know of.
Why do you stay in Johannesburg? What keeps you in South Africa?
It's my home. I was born there. I'm deeply attached to it. It's my place in life.
Your new novel concludes with, if you don't mind me giving this away, a black majority rule in South Africa. If that were to happen in your lifetime, as I know you hope that it does, how do you think your own life would be changed by it?
I would hope that many things that distress me in my own life, some of the conditions under which I must live, I'm talking about the white privileges, the fact that everything is decided by whites. I hope that will all change. I would like to see that very much.
So the privilege of the white person is a burden to you?
Yes, much of it has become a burden. Because, first of all, one goes through the stage of feeling ashamed of it. There's nothing much you can do. And if you do it on a personal level, the laws remain the same. In my life, I've come to realize that right, you can. Your own personal behavior is important, of course, toward other people. But in the end, it's the framework within which you live that counts. And that framework has been so rigid all my life that my personal defiances of it really count for very little. And what you need is to change the laws, change the social order.
What have those personal defiances been?
Well, I mean, in the 50s, I moved in a set that had strong social relations with blacks. We went in and out of black townships. We had, at that time, you were forbidden to have blacks in your house. You couldn't drink together. But we did all this, and we felt very defiant and brave. But we were not really very brave. We didn't achieve very much. We made some personal relationships that have lasted. But when we parted after the party, so to speak, the blacks went home to their black ghettos, and we went to our pleasant homes in the suburbs. That's the kind of thing that I mean.
Are there small defiances that you continue to take on now in your day-to-day life?
Some small and some a little bigger.
What are the big ones?
Well, I wouldn't really like to talk about them because
I understand.
They are things that one does that are really not for to be broadcast.
I understand.
Otherwise, one couldn't go on doing them.
You know, it's interesting. The main character in your book, Halela, has the kind of influence that she has in part because of the men who she's chosen to marry or be lovers with.
She's a kind of courtesan, really, of a new kind, of a modern kind.
Yeah, of a kind of revolutionary sort.
Yes, but if you look back in history, you know, you have Madame de Maintenon, people like that. You even have, think of Evita Peron. I see Halela somewhat in that mold, though I like her rather better.
I wonder if you see yourself as a feminist.
No. Not really. I'm a feminist insofar as I'm a humanist. I think that everybody, no matter what sex, color, creed, should have exactly the same rights.
Let me just thank you. Thank you very much for talking with us today,
thank
Nadine
you.
Gordimer.
Bye-bye.
Nadine Gordimer's new novel is called A Sport of Nature. She spoke with us from New York. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
I know you'll be trying to put into perspective the story of the American naval ship that was hit by the Iraqi missile.
We will. We have a report from David Molpis here in Washington at the Pentagon, which is still confused as to whether or not the Stark, the officers, were trying or attempted to defend against the Exocet missile that hit the ship and claimed the lives of 28 men or none.
Will you have any explanations of how it happened?
Well, we do have some interesting theorizing about the fact that the missile attack took place at night when the Iraqi Air Force has not usually been flying, certainly not that far away from Iraq. We'll also be learning some of the background of this in the Iran-Iraq War.
Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Thursday, NBC TV introduces a new sitcom called The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. Thursday night has been called the best night of television on television. Our TV critic David Bianculli thinks that's right where Molly Dodd belongs.
Let's not beat around the bush here. The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, which premieres this week on NBC, is a daring new program that does for the sitcom what Lou Grant and Hill Street Blues did for drama. It breaks the rules, it sets new standards, and it's terrific. It's kind of hard to explain what Molly Dodd is all about, but that's good. The easier a TV show is to describe, the harder it is to watch. Molly Dodd, though, is defiantly different from the start. The opening credits say only three things. One, that the title is The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. Two, that the star is Blair Brown. Three, that the creator is Jay Tarsis. That's all the credits tell you. No supporting weekly players are listed because none are guaranteed to appear. It's Brown's show. And it's about time. Blair Brown was brilliant as the prosecuting attorney in the recent miniseries Hands of a Stranger, and she's one of my very favorite actresses. Jay Tarsis, who co-produced Buffalo Bill, built this series around her. Few other performers could make it work. Brown does, beautifully. She plays Molly, a recently divorced woman in her mid-30s, who lives in New York, sells real estate, and writes poetry on the side. Here's Molly reading a sample of that poetry to the elevator operator in her apartment building.
Swollen, sunken, you see me, piecemeal, oatmeal, ravaged shape against a ghostly wall, tears and wine, and your mortar thighs clasping me, enveloping me, and losing me, loosening me, adrift in nighttime's tomb.
That's part one, huh?
Yeah, of a trilogy.
So we have two more parts to look forward to, do we?
Yes, we do.
That scene, you'll notice, has a higher literacy rate than most sitcoms. It also has no laugh track. What makes Molly Dodd even more special, though, is that it's very much like real life. There's no studio audience, so Molly is free to roam around New York. And she does. And what in this week's pilot looks like a self-contained story is actually the start of something much deeper. The poetry that Molly writes, for example, gets more bizarre and tormented from week to week. Her anguish over her ex-husband's impending marriage increases to the point where she quits her job and eventually spins out. By the fifth show, Molly has a nervous breakdown. By the sixth show, she visits a therapist. Here's the very end of that session.
Maybe I don't need to talk to someone who's not going to listen. Especially someone who's rude, is only interested in making $75 an hour. And don't worry, I will mail you the check. You want to know something? You're just not very nice.
This is obviously something quite different for a sitcom character. Mary Richards may have gotten upset when one of her parties flopped, but she didn't go lay down on Bob Newhart's couch. Molly Dodd is different. She's funnier than most TV characters. She has a career drive and a sex drive. Unlike most people on TV, she even watches TV. In this week's pilot premiere, she refers to The Jewel in the Crown and Late Night with David Letterman. The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd is a sequential saga. That's a polite term for soap opera. Each episode builds upon the ones before it. A man she meets in one episode, she dates in another. Most sitcoms can be shuffled like cards in a deck and then watched in almost any order. Molly Dodd has to be seen from the beginning, and it should be, by anyone who cares about good TV.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's what's coming up next time. On our next show, I'll speak with photographer Bruce Davidson. He spent a year underground, photographing the daily life of the New York City subway system. Rock historian Ed Ward will examine the erratic career of Louisiana swamp rocker Tommy McLean, and book critic John Leonard will review The Fortune Teller, the first novel by playwright Marcia Norman. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM.
Fresh Air is produced at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman and Audrey Voblitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.